This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 1st of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Midori House, coming to you from Bangkok today. I'm Tyler Brulé.
And I'm Gwen Robinson.
We have a jam-packed program over the next 60 minutes, so coming up, what's the status of the Thai economy? Will the country take a bigger leadership role in ASEAN? We'll get the latest from Jeep Chattakavanit, chairman of Hunter Investments. And also, Aung San Suu Kyi was in town, and so was the World Economic Forum. We'll talk foreign affairs with the EU's ambassador to the region, David Lipman. And the CEO of the Bangkok Post will pop by for a chat about the local media scene, and we'll discuss the current state of Burma with journalist Sarah Rooney. All that plus a quick masterclass on the finer points of Thai hospitality with the managing director of the soon-to-open Siam Hotel, right here on Midori House from Bangkok. But first, quickly back to London to James Luckhurst with the headlines.
Monocle 24 News, this is James Luckhurst. The top UN human rights body has called for a full UN inquiry into a massacre in the Syrian region of Houla after putting initial blame on government bombardment and gunmen loyal to President Bashar al-Assad. The 47-state forum in Geneva began an emergency session on Friday, its fourth on Syria in a year, following last week's slaughter of at least 108 people, nearly half of them children. International mediator Kofi Annan said that he was frustrated over the continued violence and killing in Syria. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, assured journalists of his government's support for Mr. Annan.
Clearly, we're supporting very strongly a United Nations process led by Kofi Annan, backed by the UN Secretary General, and all the Security Council members support that process. If it fails in the coming weeks, then we will need to return to the Security Council. And we don't know how the situation in Syria will develop, so I don't think we can rule anything out in the coming months.
A group of demonstrators from the group Reporters Without Borders gathered in Paris to protest ahead of Russian President Vladimir Putin's visit to the city today. Mr. Putin is making his first tour of Europe since being re-elected to the Russian presidency less than a month ago, having met German Chancellor Angela Merkel earlier in the day. Lucie Morillon, an activist of the group, said they'd come together to try to change the stance of the Russian government on Syria.
The people in Syria have paid a really high price to their fight for more freedom. The journalists and the freedom of information has been also a victim of this repression. And today our goal is really to put pressure on the Russian regime and to take advantage of the visit of Putin in France to also call on the French authorities to continue to put the pressure on Vladimir Putin so that the position of Syria evolves and that they stop supporting a regime that is currently massacring its own people.
Voters in the Republic of Ireland have approved the EU fiscal pact, according to official results. Some 60% of voters taking part in the referendum backed the controversial pact, which is aimed at enforcing budget rules in the Eurozone. NATO and Afghan forces have killed 14 insurgents during a rebel attack on a foreign military base in the eastern city of Khost, in one of the heaviest rebel tolls in a single incident in weeks. Several insurgents, including some wearing suicide vests, attacked the base with rocket-propelled grenades. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James Luckhurst in London, thanks very much for that. You are back with Tyler Brulé and Gwen Robinson here in what was, well, it seemed it was kind of nice when I landed a bit earlier today, but it turned
nice.
Completely, it turned rather horrendous on the way to the studios. But anyway, very nice to see you.
It's very nice to see you, and I'm sorry that you arrived all wet and with a broken umbrella, but that's Thailand.
The last time we shared a studio was up in Tokyo, and you've been, of course, dipping in and out of many of our programs. I want to talk about the World Economic Forum in a second, Gwen, and I know that you're going to be talking to the ambassador a little bit later in the program. But I guess, you know, one amazing thing, and we can maybe talk a little bit about it maybe with Jason, is just the relationship between, you know, Bangkok and Tokyo is an interesting one, because, you know, even you know, going along on the highway, you see sort of, you know, big Japanese shopping centers, you see Uniqlo's. It's even interesting looking at the music scene in this country. You see that there's a lot of cues, even from a style point of view, taken from Japan. And so I'm wondering, you know, you've been here for what, 6 months? You know, you're at the half
about
year
five,
point. Feeling comfortable in Bangkok?
Well, it's interesting you'd pick up on that, Tyler. I first lived here in the 80s, late 80s, and dating myself there, and I transferred to Japan. Then I came and went from Japan, and now I'm back in Bangkok all these years later. And it's really struck me this time, the similarities and differences between Japan and Thailand, but particularly Tokyo and Bangkok. And there are actually some surprising similarities, commonalities, and you can see why this, Bangkok, is one of the biggest destinations for Japanese expatriates outside of, I think, China. I think it's the second top one of the embassy people were telling me. And it's extraordinary the way Japanese seem to love Thailand.
I mean, and part of it, of course, is just... Yeah, the manufacturing base that exists here. I mean, whether it is the likes of the Suzukis, the Mitsubishis, whether you want air conditioners made, I mean, it's quite... And obviously this has, you know, probably been, you know, quite a big talking point. I'm sure we'll be you know, looking into the relationship this country has, not just with Japan, the importance of also Korea, you know, as well, and Korea Incorporated. And I think we can certainly unpack that over, I guess, what, the next 50-odd minutes. In a moment, though, we're going to be talking and reflecting on what happened with the World Economic Forum. You're listening to Midori House. We're in Bangkok. We're back after this. You're back with Midori House here in Bangkok. Well, Thailand's economic growth is constrained by outdated regulations, corruption, and a severely lacking education system. Well, at least that was the consensus during the World Economic Forum in Bangkok over the past few days. The country needs to create a better business environment, they said, and policymakers need to lead the way by breaking down the bureaucracy. But what are the strengths of the Thai economy, and how does it rank within ASEAN? Well, to talk more about that, I'm joined by Jeep Chattakanavit here in the studio, and of course, Gwen Robinson from the FT is still with me. I wanted to, when we were talking about at the top of the program, just your impressions of WEF over the past few days, but Jeep, from your point of view, what the speakers were saying in the various sessions, did it chime with you? Were they being a little bit harsh? Because it's interesting, as we've been doing these surveys, we, you know, of course, we did also even looking at Thailand from a tourism perspective over the last 2 months in the magazine, and there's still this global perspective of poor Thailand. There was, you know, look what happened last year, and of course, it was bad. At the same time, though, I mean, you've seen quite extraordinary economic growth. So I'm wondering, what did you make of what the rest of what the rest of the world had to say for the past few days?
Well, I think what the rest of the world is saying is what people generally see, but I think they are by and large missing out on the real story of Thailand, which is the resiliency, the interlinkage between Thailand and within ASEAN. As you know, we were mentioning earlier, 10 years ago, 50% of our export went to the US, the EU, and Japan, and today it's less than one-third. Today we export more to the so-called LVMC countries, Laos, Vietnam, Myanmar, and Cambodia, combined more than to the four big EU economies of Germany, Italy, France, and the UK.
Extraordinary.
I mean, do you see that as a positive? Because I think some would argue, though, that, you know, then it becomes, I mean, it's, I'm sure it's great to, of course, have hungry markets on your own doorstep, but it also does something from a national brand point of view, which is just getting Thai produce, you know, in front of people around the world as well. I mean, I don't mean just, you know, we're not talking about just rice, but also products as well.
I think it's great because that's a route that we chose 25 years ago. Our northern regional counterparts chose to go the regional national champion route. Thailand made a decision over 20 years ago that we are going to have a national car, and that's going to be called Toyota. So we chose the FDI route, and as a result, a lot of technology transfer has happened. The scale of the workforce has scaled up. There's a massive sort of infrastructure support for the automobile industry, petrochem industry, which is very, very difficult to replicate anywhere else. And so even after the floods of last year, that's one of the reasons why you didn't see any investors pulling out. Mm. In fact, the Japanese, the Americans, they're doubling their, increasing their investments.
Gwen, this government's had to work quite hard, though. The prime minister has been spending a lot of time up in Tokyo, a lot of time in Seoul, so it hasn't come easy. I would imagine that there has been, you know, quite a bit of hand-holding, and probably in advance of this week, I would certainly think that there was discussions, whether they were in Tokyo or in Nagoya, just to say, you know, we're going to, you know, get our house in order. So, you know, as catastrophic as this was, there will also be the appropriate defenses to make sure that we don't see the likes of Toyota and everyone upping sticks and going elsewhere.
Indeed. But that's why I think, and I agree with Jeep, that overall the message is just savvy. They've been very savvy. Like, as soon as these floods really, it really seemed apparent that the floods were really serious, they did go into panic control mode. There was a lot of domestic criticism about, and I'm sure, Jeep, you have some views of that, about how the government handled it all. But actually, in the end, what, looking back, I think they've been incredibly smart about prioritising the assurance to their foreign investor base, getting themselves to Japan, getting themselves to, you know, all the foreign chambers of commerce, and putting in place the most amazing array of incentives, not just to stay and rebuild, but possibly to invest more. Incredible. I'm sure you're aware of all that.
Yes, and credit to them, really. Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's the numbers that counts. Mm. And this is the numbers is actually one of the things that majority of overseas investors, when they look at Thailand along with the rest of Southeast Asia, have continued to miss. The past 5 years, a lot of global flows have flown into the so-called BRICS, the large emerging markets. And if you look at the MSCI BRICS index, that numbers are flat for the past 3 years. Thailand is up 120%.
Sorry, Gwen. I was just going to say that you know, we're talking about sort of the resiliency. What is it? And I mean, you know, while of course on the ground here, what do you see even in terms of the DNA? Because we can talk about, you know, governments being clever or governments, you know, being able to look over the horizon, all of these things. But, you know, I know even talking to and having been up in Japan recently, you know, and you bring up Toyota, it is quite interesting. You know, Toyota will say that, you know, the productivity, you know, in Thailand is perhaps the best in the world. You know, everyone likes to talk about Toyota USA,
right?
But they look to Thailand. So you know that, you know, the government can do many things, but what is it, you know, within the DNA even that makes this tick?
Well, first of all, I think we have to be careful not to give any government too much credit.
Sure.
I think the majority of the credit has to go to the Thai private sector.
Yeah.
Which is hardworking, innovative, and when Gwen mentions the resiliency or the Teflon Thailand, I think it comes back to the balance sheet. The fact that our companies can generate north of 15% return on equity on very, very, almost no debt is very, very impressive. And I think that's a bottom line resiliency.
But surely that is part of what Tyler is talking about with DNA, that, you know, in some ways there's some very savvy managing going on here, and Thais themselves as Thai workers.
And I was going to say, that's almost cultural. I mean, to also, to be running your business on, you know, that's not something which is something that was dreamt up by an MBA 10 years ago.
No. It was drummed into us from the School of Hard Knocks, 97-98 Asian financial crisis. Mm. And the pendulum almost, you know, swung.
Is that memory still long?
Yes, it is.
You think that still governs?
Well, as of 2 years ago, it definitely was. You know, when I first launched a fund in 05, Thailand was often criticized that we have a lazy balance sheet. People weren't willing to invest because there was so much excess capacity. And people so debt averse. But now though, 10 years, more than 10 years after that crisis, Thai corporates and Thai companies, Thai managements now begin to feel more self-confident about where Thailand is, Thailand places in the world, and they realize now that they can compete because they have been forced to compete in a very ruthless global market. And now they're beginning to go out and acquire businesses again and begin to use their balance sheet again.
Right. Gwen, for you, of course, covering the patch all the time. Do you see that that there is that sense of you know jumping on your Thai 777 and flying out there on an acquisition trail? And is that a lot of also almost the importance of this base for the Financial Times as well? Because of a potentially or an acquisitive nature here?
No, not so much. In fact, I think the M&A, the thirst for the what Jeep's talking about is a fairly new phenomenon. And it does, as he says, lead back to the Asian financial crisis, the lessons learned, and how Thai companies have stored up cash on their balance sheets, and now they are going out there and buying companies. And it's interesting to see. And I'd say that's a new phase, actually.
Ajit, just before we go, dark clouds on the horizon. I mean, aside from the rather biblical storm
that we all
had to endure on the way into the studio just now. Three things that you would say that, business people or people coming into this country, need to be careful about, and three things they need to be excited about. Not to put you on the spot.
Oh my God.
It doesn't have to be six, yeah. But.
Well, three things that they have to be careful about is not to get too sucked into politics. Politics to me is noise. I run a fund and our policies ignore that particular noise. Secondly, not to all the time treat the Thai smile sort of at face value.
It's the land of smiles.
On the positive side, there is a pool of skillful labor here. Although we are demographically, we're not as young as a lot of our regional counterparts, but Thais are getting wealthier. Most people wouldn't realize that. In terms of GDP per capita, Bangkok ranks only sixth in the country. That means wealth is spreading outside.
Mm. That's very interesting.
And with this current government plan of putting high-speed rail and the connectivity between not just in Thailand, but through the rest of ASEAN, that development is only going to grow. I think, I really do feel that we're at a cusp of a major change here, if we can get through the politics. I think it's an exciting time.
Great. Jeep Chatty Cabinet, thanks very much for joining us. You are listening to Midori House. We're in Bangkok. We're back right after this break.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
And you're back with Midori House here in Bangkok. Well, earlier this week, the Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi arrived in Thailand in her first trip abroad in 24 years. Addressing political and business leaders at the World Economic Forum, Suu Kyi called for a skeptical approach to the nascent reforms of her government. In the 15-minute speech, she urged against naive optimism over the future of Burma, saying, "I would not like you to be over-optimistic. I think optimism is good, but cautious optimism." Well, a little earlier, Gwen sat down with David Lipman, the ambassador and head of delegation of the European Union to Thailand, Laos, and Myanmar.
What has happened in the last 12 to 15 months in Myanmar has been something quite remarkable. The changes go beyond what anybody could have predicted, even seasoned observers. And you say you saw her today and yesterday behaving in an amazing way, almost like a rock star. Well, this has been building up for a while now, and this doesn't come as a surprise to me. If we go back a little bit to her first period under house arrest, and when she was just released, and that was December, some 15, 16 months ago now, she behaved very quietly, in fact, and was not searching for any media support or any publicity at all. But things gradually evolved as she built up a relationship with Thein Sein. Thein Sein, of course, is the president of Myanmar, And things started really moving, I would say, on the 19th of August last year when she met him for the first time. And they struck up quite a remarkable working relationship, a relationship of trust. And since then, things have moved on fantastically. She has, for example, decided to participate in the electoral process in Myanmar, something that she didn't want to do. And the laws of the country were changed to enable her to do that. And she's shown a lot of flexibility. And of course, she had a remarkable success in the recent by-elections, winning 43 seats out of 45. And over this period, of course, she left Yangon, she traveled around the country, and so she's been getting more and more used to dealing with big crowds and dealing with people. And of course, there's been a succession of high level visits from everybody, from Hillary Clinton to the British Prime Minister to many ministers of the European Union to that country as well. And so she has got used to this sort of thing. And now, of course, it's second nature to her. She knows how to handle these things. But at the beginning, no, I mean, it took a long time. So right. There have been big changes.
Indeed. And actually, though, I was thinking, I was sitting in that hall today when she came in, and I was thinking, having covered her on the election campaign trail, as I think you might have had some visits to Myanmar while she was campaigning. But that's a big leap from standing on a stage, even with what we saw in Mandalay and her speeches there to crowds of estimated at 100,000. That's an awful lot of people, but it's a bit different in the home environment campaigning, you know, in rural areas or in country towns, to walking in on your first visit outside of the country in 24 years to a room full of, you know, heavyweight business people, you know, other cabinet ministers from regional governments, all kinds of people in a luxury hotel in the central Bangkok with all the bright lights. So were you surprised at all about her? Just the way she seemed to handle it was—it surprised even me, really.
Mm. No, well, I wasn't really surprised because, first of all, she's a remarkable person by any stretch of the imagination, and secondly, she started to get a machinery behind her as a politician. Her political party is now much better organized. She's got a lot of young people, dynamic people, who I've met myself, who are working for her now. And so she has the proper preparation. I mean, it's not improvised. In my view, it's very well prepared by a very professional team. So that's a big change.
That's very interesting. I know that... you know, some people expected her possibly to be, given what you said about her good relationship with President Thein Sein, that expected her perhaps to be a little more overall positive about getting foreign business engaged in Myanmar, about the overall message. But in fact, the message was mixed. To put even the best face on it, she warned that reforms are not irreversible, that she does trust the president, but he's only one person, and there's the military that still controls a quarter of parliament, and that she also warned business about against possibly what she called reckless optimism and feeling that you could just pile in and make a profit and invest in Myanmar that easily. She said there is no real rule of law, so even with forthcoming laws on foreign investment, she did caution that you can have the best investment law in the world, but if you don't have clean and functioning courts, you might get into trouble. Do you feel that she really had thought this out, that, you know, that she wanted to mix the negative with the positive, and how people might respond to that? Would investors sort of think twice being warned by this big pro-democracy icon, or will they think, well, you know, she's political and she was a former activist, you know, they would just carry on regardless and pile into this new frontier that's opening up.
Yeah, Gwen, I hear what you're saying, but I think, first of all, I should say a few words about what the European Union has been doing, because, as you know, we have suspended our sanctions at the beginning of May, and we have taken an approach now that we want to encourage trade, we want to encourage investment, and we want to help to support this momentum for change. I mean, we have a clear policy now, a unanimous policy. And of course, in some respects, she's perfectly right. Of course, nothing is irreversible in life. I mean, as we know, there are only two certainties in life, and that is death and taxes. And we all know that. And so nothing is irreversible. And I think that one always has to be somewhat cautious. But I'm personally an optimist, and I think that the country has a very good future. And I think one of the main reasons why the future is good for Myanmar is that not only do you have a president who is committed to reform and has got a number of remarkable people around him, but they also have a leader of the opposition in Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a remarkable woman who wants peaceful change. Mm-hmm. And this is something that you don't have in every country in the world which is trying to reform itself. So I really do believe, and I am optimistic, that because we have these two people, on the one hand the president who wants change, and on the other hand, Aung San Suu Kyi, who is working for change as well, that the future is very good for this country.
Right. I'll just, that's also a very good point. I'll just leave Myanmar with perhaps one more question, which is absolutely based on your last point, which is, you're right, the two most important people to the future of this country, for now anyway, are Aung San Suu Kyi and President Thein Sein, the two reformers. I wonder, you know, it has been asked before, I suppose, but if anything were to happen to these two people tonight, you know, what are we looking at? What is your feeling about that? Has Aung San Suu Kyi become bigger than her cause in a way? And has Thein Sein created a kind of a reformist frenzy that's driven by one man, or do you think that that we can have some sort of confidence that these kind of directions will continue, even if you know, there are changes, rapid, dramatic changes?
Well, there will be changes in Myanmar. There is no doubt that there is talk, and I don't know whether it's true or not, that there may be a government reshuffle in the next month or two. We shall see. But there's a lot of speculation that that will happen. And there will be changes. The president, of course, will carry on. But there will be changes. And there will be elections in 2015, which will set a new scenario. I mean, that's not long off. And I think, of course, that things will change. But as I said before, I'm absolutely convinced that at the moment things are on the right track, and we should support and encourage what's happening at the moment. There will be changes, but I personally believe the changes will only be positive.
And that was Ambassador David Lipman of the EU talking to our Gwen Robinson. Gwen, what stood out, and I guess I also want to go back to just almost the incident that was caused, which we didn't really go into with Aung San Suu Kyi coming here, because, you know, of course, we spoke about it very earlier in the week. Mm. That seeing that the leadership decided not to go, they let her, make this trip, and it's quite remarkable, isn't it? Because, you know, in many ways, it almost sort of worked in everyone's favor. It looked quite smart on the part of certainly Myanmar's leadership, but of course worked for. It also worked very well in terms of also quite a coup to also have Aung San Suu Kyi making her first trip to Thailand.
Well, let's say it was the biggest coup for the World Economic Forum, I think. It was the absolute, star sort of item on the whole two-day agenda. And it was clear when she walked in that, there was mass excitement about her presence there. So I think the other little tidbit is that I think the World Economic Forum has done a deal with the Burmese to hold the WEF Asia next year in Myanmar. And that's hot off the press, that news. So, in fact, it's been good all round. I think there's winners all round. Aung San Suu Kyi, the Myanmar government, although I think, as you referred to, there was a little bit of an upset. The president of Myanmar, Thein Sein, cancelled his appearance at World Economic Forum here after learning that Aung San Suu Kyi was also coming, and nobody had apparently told the others who was doing what.
Mm.
So he will arrive on Monday. For Aung San Suu Kyi, I think it was a great practice run as well, because let's not forget, in 2 weeks' time, she's going to be landing in London. She'll address British Parliament and do a whole bunch of other things in Europe. So this was, in some ways for her, a really great little trip to do, to come out after 24 years, you know, in isolation.
Mm. We're going to go away for a short break. We're back in a moment.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
This is Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And coming up in the next half hour of the special Bangkok edition of Midori House here on Monocle 24, we'll chat to Supakorn Vejajiva, the CEO of the Bangkok Post, and we'll also be joined by journalist Sarah Rooney, and we'll be getting a tour, at least an audio tour, of the latest new hostel to be opening up here in Bangkok, the Siam Hotel. We'll be chatting to Jason Friedman. But first, back to London to James Luckhurst with the headlines.
The top UN human rights body has called for a full UN inquiry into a massacre in the Syrian region of Houla after putting initial blame on government bombardment and gunmen loyal to President Bashar al-Assad. The 47-state forum in Geneva began an emergency session on Friday, its fourth on Syria in a year, following last week's slaughter of at least 108 people, nearly half of them children. A group of demonstrators from the group Reporters Without Borders gathered in Paris to protest ahead of Russian President Vladimir Putin's visit to the city today. Mr. Putin is making his first tour of Europe since being re-elected to the Russian presidency less than a month ago, having met German Chancellor Angela Merkel earlier on in the day. Voters in the Republic of Ireland have approved the EU fiscal pact, according to official results. Some 60% of voters taking part in the referendum backed the controversial pact, which is aimed at enforcing budget rules in the Eurozone. And Sudan has said that it's completed its withdrawal of troops from the disputed Abyei region bordering South Sudan. And those are the headlines at Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we are in Bangkok, where the Bangkok Post is the paper, well, which many English speakers carry and read in this town. Gwen, I should probably ask you, is that entirely true? I know they've got the pink newspaper under their arm as well. But.
No, unfortunately, pink newspaper is not available until 3 or 4 in the afternoon.
Until it lands.
And it costs about 5 times as much. In fact, for me, living and working in Bangkok, I'd say the Bangkok Post is an absolute essential. As is, I have to say, the other main English language newspaper.
Well,
the Nation,
we'll come back. We'll come back to that other newspaper in a second. But I want to introduce the CEO of the Bangkok Post, Supakorn Vejajiva. He joins us in the studio. We were chatting last week. I wanted to just start, Supakorn, by asking you, where does the newspaper sit? Not just within the land and within the confines of the Thai border, but also regionally, because we've just come off the back of this regional edition of the World Economic Forum, and I guess there's two sides to it, the role it plays within this country, but also beyond its borders.
I think the role we play in the country is quite, we've been here a while, we've been here 60 years, and I think the changes that happened in Thailand over the last 10 years, 10 or 20 years, we played quite a big role in reporting that to the world and also to English-speaking Thais and expatriates living here. Mm. But regionally, I think we've been trying to project our independence as a voice, independent voice in the region. And even though the coverage for ASEAN or for Vietnam and Burma, in Asia in general, even though we don't have correspondents everywhere, the articles and the opinion pieces in the editorial pages reflect what we want to be regionally. in terms of being an influence on the Asian affairs.
Now, Gwen, you mentioned the other newspaper, this being a two newspaper town, English language that is, not to mention, of course, all of the Thai press. Are people one or the other? Are they either looking at the Bangkok Post or are they reading The Nation, or do people also take both, do you think?
Well, I'm sure Supercon has his own research that might tell us more, but my feeling is that for most foreigners living here, it's one or the other. And it's more for, you know, specialists who are interested, vitally interested in business or media here, or, you know, politics, where you get both. I couldn't live without both. I need both. I do like some of the sections of the Post, I must say. What's your view?
I think for people who take both, most people I know take both, but I think we have separate readership from The Nation in terms of maybe expatriates living outside Bangkok. We distribute all around the country, whereas The Nation will be more focused on Bangkok.
Mm. That's true.
And we have big readership in Phuket, in Chiang Mai. And of course now Pattaya and Hua Hin.
Right, but interestingly, tell me, I just learned from one of your colleagues that you've really gone into the electronic side as well with this television and also your Thai language operations as well.
Yes, I think we've expanded a lot in the last 10 years. We've had one paper for 50 years. We've been a one paper company for 50 years. I joined 10 years ago, and I think we started doing Thai newspapers. We just launched a free tabloid, and now we've into television. More satellite TV, and also we've done a lot of Thai magazines now.
And as a result, and just building up this type of stable, I wonder, Gwen, do you think that there is room for the title of Record? I mean, in the same way, okay, yes, the FT is a London-based newspaper, it's global, and we can talk about the IHT and what's become of the Wall Street Journal, but do you think there's room for an English-language paper that is... that really reflects ASEAN, as we've been talking about, that has, can be called the Bangkok Post, but everyone needs to read it in Jakarta, and they need to read it in Yangon, and they also need to read it in Singapore.
Yeah, there's definitely room for that, but I think that's a long way off as far as all the ASEAN nations go, because I think each of these countries has their version of the Bangkok Post or whatever, their main English language paper. So,
but I'm thinking about a lazy consumer who just wants one place to go, saying that newspaper got there first. And, they've got the most correspondence in the region and they really know their patch.
Definitely. I'm sure, Supercon, you have ideas too, but I would say that the real key here is distribution. If you're there and, at all the outlets, but, let's see, that is a good case to make for ASEAN distribution. If you can get a newspaper that is selling first thing in the morning in every ASEAN capital. But what's your thoughts on that?
You were saying earlier, Gwen, about the FT arriving a bit late every day in Bangkok. I think it's a big issue for distribution. But I think now it's much easier when you can print everywhere. You can send your pages everywhere. So we've had distribution deals in different cities. But I think more importantly, it's the writing and the journalism, that if we can reflect and project what other newspapers in ASEAN cannot, whether it's Singapore or Jakarta.
Right.
I think the Bangkok Post has a positioning which can, or even the name, to talk about at least Burma, Vietnam, and the sub-region. We can start there. I think we've been beefing up the coverage there, and as well as Asian business. That's what we've been doing in the last year on a new section called Asia Focus.
Supercorn.
Yep.
In other cities, well, certainly in so many markets around the world, being in your position, being the CEO of a newspaper group is a very depressing job. and everyone is sitting there, of course, newspapers have always been in the game of being competitive, maybe not always innovative. But now you hear so many people, they're so beaten down and because they just, they see sort of endless decline. However, you can look at a lot of emerging markets. You can, you can look at Brazil and you see more newsprint being bought and new printing presses being bought, and we can see the same thing in India. And so I'm wondering the balance here. Of course, this is a market of early adopters. I've never seen more people, using BBM and having sort of operating four phones at once, etc. So yes, clearly a market of early adopters. But what does it mean for someone like the Post and for a brand like the Post? Are you pretty optimistic about things?
I think we are very optimistic on newspapers, which is different to whatever happening in London or in New York. We bought our new presses recently. Mm. It's probably the people joke. It's probably the last one in Southeast Asia. But we are optimistic on our print products, and I think whatever we do in other media, we try to get the brand out and everything. But it comes back to being able to support our flagship, which is the Bangkok Post newspaper. Mm. And we put a lot of investment and resources into the Bangkok Post itself, even though the TV and the magazines, fashion magazines.
Well, and make, the online version.
Online, we don't make that much money off online.
Nobody does.
I don't think, exactly.
Yeah, we know.
We know all about that.
And then I'm not scared to say that. Every time you go to a newspaper or media conference in Europe.
Yeah, you're a heretic if you say that. I mean, yeah.
Online. But here, your viewership has gone from the paper a little bit, mm-hmm. especially in Bangkok, because people go onto the website.
Sure.
But the number of people we get on the website is still less than we get for the print product.
Right.
And then, of course, the revenue is not there either. So right. So I'm not. I think I'm jumping in across into mobile. It's probably more direct and more useful for Thai consumers.
Well, especially if you're sitting in traffic for 2 hours.
Sure. Yes, exactly.
Gwen, just before you go, what is your take on the media market here? Looking at television, listening to radio, looking at all of the print. I mean, the one thing that does surprise me, Supercorn, you know, we were chatting about it last Friday as well, is just the number of licensed editions. And it's amazing to see that, you know, here's a country that was on the case very early, having their own edition of Business Week, for example. You guys brought, I guess, Elle into the country as well. You've got Vogue is coming here. Mm. Are you impressed? Or, you know, I mean, versus
yeah,
sort
I
of
am.
Japan and elsewhere and time you've spent in Hong Kong and, you know, other ports.
No, I am. I have to say, I must say, from outside the region, you often get this slightly snobby attitude amongst, particularly in the West, that, you know, no media in Asian countries could be, you know, as good or sophisticated or as mature. But I think the Thai market is amazing for its embrace of, you know, new titles, mm-hmm. the proliferation of titles. Thais also love new things, hip things. So I think it's a very good market for you know, testing and trying different magazines. But unfortunately, a lot of that is in the local language.
Thai, yeah.
Yeah, it's in Thai.
Yes.
So the English, but, you know, still, it tells you a lot about this country that there's so much curiosity for new things and media. And people want to read. People love dead trees.
It's a new magazine every month being launched.
Right.
Whether it's women's magazines, cars, yeah. or whatever. But I think there's a lack of serious business or political magazines.
Ah, yes. Well, that's another whole story.
Yeah, that is another special
maybe
edition.
Maybe we should ask Tyler if he's got plans for Monaco and Thai.
You never know. It's distribution. As much as we have very loyal readers in this country, many of whom we'll see tomorrow night when we do our event, it's, distribution is an issue. Supercorn and Vijay, we're going to have to leave it there. CEO
Thank you.
Of the Bangkok Post. You are listening to Midori House with Tyler Berlay and Gwen Robinson. We're in Bangkok. We're back after this.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
And you're back with Midori House here in Bangkok with Tyler Brulé and Gwen Robinson of the Financial Times. Gwen, just a little bit earlier in the program, and also earlier in the week as well, we were talking about who some of the winners might turn out to be. In terms of really the jumping off point into Yangon, and from your perspective, and there's been a lot of focus on connectivity already this week, is it a Singapore or is it this city that you think benefits?
Well, since the theme of the whole thing at the WEF was connectivity in Southeast Asia or ASEAN rather, we had detailed explanations from everyone, from Yingluck, the Prime Minister of Thailand, to the Lao Prime Minister and the Vietnamese Prime Minister about, you know, their great plans, actual and future, for, you know, building in rail links, transport links of all sorts. They were talking about you know, the ports and infrastructures and highways to connect up the whole region. You came away from that thinking, gee, everybody's going to be a winner. Mm. But definitely, particularly the countries that are neighbouring Myanmar, I think, particularly Thailand with its rail links and Laos as well is right in there. And of course, the Chinese who rated a mention with their various projects. So I think there's actually enough for all to go around, and the Singaporeans are also very well placed with air routes and things. Mm. So,
There's so much focus on, of course, you know, big infrastructure initiatives and, you know, deepening ports and doing all of those things. But I thought we should bring Sarah Rooney into the conversation. Sarah has just completed a book, which is called 30 Heritage Buildings of Yangon. I hope I have that right. It is 30
Absolutely.
Heritage Buildings. Sarah, welcome. I want to just pick up on that. You know, everyone is of course looking to the rise. And as I was saying, at all these big infrastructure initiatives, you know, you've spent a lot of time, of course, in the country, trekking around the region. What was the idea of a book? Was this sort of a call to action to say, look at government sitting in Myanmar, that this is something you need to really pay attention to? Because also, you know, when you look at also just tourism receipts, you know, authenticity tends to you know, be quite a strong suit.
Sure. Well, the idea for the book actually started with the Association of Myanmar Architects. And it was kind of their idea to draw attention to these buildings that exist in downtown Yangon, these colonial era buildings, which have been sort of neglected and have been crumbling and are very, very dilapidated now after some 50 years of dictatorship. So now with the country opening up, it's a really incredible, I think, opportunity to protect these buildings, to save them, to restore them, to find new uses for them that can feed back into the communities that exist around them. You know, they can be a financial resource for the city as well. And if you look around the region at just how many of these old buildings have been knocked down and replaced by towering skyscrapers, this search for the new and the shiny, I think Yangon has a really exciting opportunity at the moment to capture something that the rest of the region has let go.
Well, tell us about a couple of your most favourite ones. Surely the Secretariat building.
Oh, for sure, yeah. The Secretariat is the head where the British administration had its headquarters, and it's a massive sort of Victorian rambling pile now. It's mostly derelict, and it was quite damaged in Cyclone Nargis, the big cyclone in 2008. But now it's just this incredible, incredible location. But it also has some sensitivities because the father of Aung San Suu Kyi was assassinated there in 1947. So there's a it has an almost sort of, it's become almost like a pilgrimage site of sorts, and it's a bit sensitive as to what might happen to it. But obviously you're going to need a lot of money to do something with such a big property. You know?
When you mentioned the sensitivity issue, just because it might fall into the hands of the wrong developers, or is there a recognition to protect these structures, though?
I think a bit of both, yeah. The idea is, I think, that the wing, I think he was killed in the southwest wing, it already is a little sort of shrine there, but there is an access for the public. I mean, I think eventually there should be, and people would want there to be, but it was proposed that it become a hotel and the whole property.
That would be enormous.
Yeah, that was very, very unpopular. Mm. And it was vetoed in the end by one of the ministers. So.
Just on that note, do you think that the government, you know, now sitting in their somewhat shiny new capital, I think also, you know, recognize just, you know, and going back to the earlier point, I mean, the importance of what they're sitting on right now, and what that will mean in terms of, you know, inward tourism receipts.
I hope so, and that's one of the ideas.
Hope so, or do you think it will happen?
Well, you know, I mean, that's one of the ideas behind the book, is to try and convince them that that's the case. The book has now gone out to various ministers. It will be translated into Burmese and hopefully circulated in the right places in Naypyidaw.
Well, and also it's going to be selling in Europe and America and through the region.
I mean,
region,
the idea
right?
is to get as much attention as possible. And I think the more attention is focused on the buildings and the more talk there is about what the financial possibilities are, the more interest there might be from Naypyidaw.
And I'm wondering right now with this great rush, I mean, Gwen, you've been, you know, it almost seems like you're on a permanent shuttle into Yangon from Bangkok. And every time we've been talking, you just it's incredible, of course, just, you know, this great rush to see what's there. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering on a development side, and I'll ask both of you, do you think that there are, Yeah, I guess whether there's legislation in place already to make sure that it's not going to be, you know, this incredible gold rush and people be there with the wrecking balls. And Sarah, I mean, what is your view?
In terms of the legislation in
place? Yeah, and just, you know, there is a sense not even just the 30 buildings that you talk about,
sure,
but just in terms of having the appropriate mandates to make sure that, you know, here's a country that doesn't, you know, fall into the same traps that even parts of this country have, certainly.
Sure, there's a very rudimentary, there's probably no proper legislation in place right now. There's a very rudimentary list of, I think, 189 buildings, which is the Yangon municipal authorities. Have listed as buildings that must be protected. If you want to change them or demolish them, you first have to apply to the municipal authority. So right now, actually, today, I think, is the last day of a conference that's going on in Yangon at the moment, which is being run by a newly founded Yangon Heritage Trust, which aims to brainstorm and create ideas for what sort of legislation could be put in place. Because this has happened in other cities in Europe and in the States and places, right? There are protection mechanisms. So I think the idea is to bring the expertise from all these different countries together and see how it can play out in a place like Yangon.
Yes, I think that conference also has succeeded, or the people behind it, including one author, Tantmit Yu, has succeeded in at least drawing enough attention already to put in place, I think, an informal moratorium on the destruction of any building older than preceding 1960.
Mm.
So that would be sort of 52-year-old buildings. So that's already moved things, I think, ahead considerably. And, of course, you've got this massive nascent tourism boom happening or about to happen. And I think a lot of people want to sort of throw up cheap hotels overnight just to get... I mean, there is an absolutely critical need. I'm sure, Sarah, you have seen that for accommodation in, well, not just Yangon,
sure,
but I think Yangon's particularly critical. We've seen hotel rates at some of my favourite places rise from about $60 a night just a year ago,
yeah,
to $250.
Mm.
That's not bad in 1 year.
I'm sorry, just before we go, from a prognosis point of view, are you hopeful that everyone will get on message?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the potential is so great. You know, there's nothing like it in the region. It would be so exciting if it works out.
Great. Sarah Rooney, author of the book 30 Heritage Buildings in Yangon. It's on bookshelves across the region and also elsewhere around the world. You're listening to Midori House. We're in Bangkok. We're back in a moment. And you're back with Midori House here in Bangkok with Tyler Brulé and Gwen Robinson of the Financial Times. Well, Thais are, of course, famous around the world for their hospitality. It's known as the land of 1,000 smiles for many reasons. Whether it's a street vendor or a 5-star hotel, the attentiveness to service is in top shape. Gwen, I have to ask you, would you agree? As of course, a diehard Tokyoite in one guise, is it...
Well, it's a slightly different style, but I would say yes. There's some odd similarities. I was really struck by that.
Yeah, I think that's why the Japanese like it so much here. But
exactly.
Anyway, we should probably bring in our next guest. Jason Friedman became the general manager of the Bangkok-based Siam Hotel, which I tried to book into this trip. I'm hoping if this interview goes well, I will be able to check into the proper next week. He's a graduate of Cornell. He's worked at many properties, very highly respected properties all around Southeast Asia. Jason, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, you had we had, of course, a small piece in our current surveys about the property. A great piece of the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago in How to Spend It magazine about the property as well. So many see this as perhaps one of the most saturated, most competitive markets in the world. I mean, every brand is represented here. You've got also the Park Hyatt is going to be coming online soon. What is the Siam bringing to the table that's going to be different?
We're actually building a hotel that's strictly built for the luxury leisure traveler. And this is a market that's always been in high demand in Thailand, in Bangkok especially, but nobody's ever built a hotel specifically for
that
market.
Isn't the Oriental going to have something to say about that and lots of other people?
Sure they will, but the Oriental is a luxury business hotel. It's a luxury business city hotel. So if you're a luxury leisure traveler on your grand tour of Asia, your grand tour of Thailand, there's a disconnect when you get to Bangkok. You leave Trisara, you're on your way to Amantaka, you get to Bangkok, you're in a business hotel. a very nice business hotel, but that's what it is. Mm. Nobody's ever built the luxury leisure hotel in Bangkok, and that's what we've done with the Siam.
Gwen, is that fair?
Well, I'm really curious to hear the Oriental described as a luxury business hotel. I mean, many who stay there would not
regard themselves. This is a hotel with 450 rooms, 9% suite mix. That's 39 suites. That's the leisure section. Mm. The other 400 rooms, that's the business part of it.
Right, and you have precisely
39 suites. Correct. Right.
Which is still, you know, given what you're trying to do, that is some scale, in fact, as well. I mean, oftentimes people would even say that probably, you know, 12 or 14, but I guess there is probably, you know, as a graduate of Cornell, there is a magic number, isn't there, to making money. I've always been told that sort of you need at least 40, some, or maybe 60 rooms to make it viable.
Depending on rate, it's about 30 to 40 rooms. And
right.
I think Adrian Zecca with Aman Resorts nailed that number years ago.
Yeah.
You know, we built 15 rooms for Four Seasons up in the Golden Triangle, which worked very, very well, became the best hotel in the world for 3 years. But 15 rooms was hard to make money on its own, so we had to work with economies of scale from Four Seasons in Chiang Mai and Bangkok. What we're doing now at the Siam is a complete standalone property with the full infrastructure to support it. Mm. So 39 rooms allows us to be profitable, but it also allows us to be focused on the individual guest and provide that level of luxury service you can't find in a bigger hotel.
I want to ask both of you, maybe Jason first, do you think that there is a recognition and an understanding of, you know, how well they do it in this country, or is it just sort of, you know, taken for granted? Because I think this is the one, you know, of course the country is able to market itself and it's very active and they've been talking it up around the World Economic Forum as well, Thai hospitality. But, you know, at a time when it's, you know, every economy has to fight based on service. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they're shouting loud enough, selling themselves enough in this market? Because when we were chatting about, you know, kind of a catastrophic trip that I had to Hawaii, I thought, why would you? I don't understand why the Japanese get on a plane to Hawaii. I mean, I can understand sort of historical reasons why they go, but, you know, when you can come here and have non-unionized, you know, perfectly polite, yeah, and where it's incredibly natural as well, as opposed to sort of, you know, grumpy, you know, I could be lifting cargo on a C-130 at the Air Force Base, or I could also be serving drinks. Doesn't really matter.
Doesn't really matter. The Thais are happy to do whatever they happen to be doing. They're just genuinely happy people. You know, and that's why for me it's such a pleasure to be working in Thailand, because in the service business, because it just comes so naturally. You know, I just came from Australia where I was running a hotel, and it's, you know, a nightmare to provide luxury service there because it's not part of the culture.
Right.
Whereas in Thailand, it is. People outside Thailand know that Thailand is a great country for service, but the Thais themselves don't really know because that's just the way they are naturally. So I do think there's a great opportunity for the Thais to promote themselves on the service that they offer. Mm.
Gwen, I just want to ask you then, just go back to that question then. Recognition here that they've got an extraordinary asset, and do you think they're selling it hard enough?
Well, I tend to agree with Jason. I don't think that they really realize, internally, but definitely overseas. Although it is very interesting that, having lived in Japan for some years, as you well know, you know, the Japanese who are inveterate, you know, traveler, love their particular, you know, sort of resort areas and their holidays. And I agree, so many of them are fixated on Hawaii. But the ones who are not tend to, you know, if you love Thailand, you really are loyal to it. You keep going back. But if you don't have much experience of it, you don't. So I think in some ways that the Thais need to get that message out there more, perhaps.
Absolutely.
So I'm just interested how you might get the word on something.
Well, you know, the word is out there to the general public. I mean, every time something happens in Thailand, Thailand bounces back very quickly.
Sure. Because
people around the world that know Thailand, that travel to Thailand, they want it to come back quickly. They want to believe it's all okay.
Right.
And they know it's okay because nothing here ever targets foreigners.
That's right.
It's all internal stuff. It's just about themselves.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with us. And everybody here knows it.
Well, except when it's natural disasters, right?
Right, and but that's different. But still, it bounces back. People continue to come back. And if it happens in Bali, it takes a decade to come back.
Yeah.
Here, people come back right away, thankfully.
Just before we go, give us 2, 3, 5 compelling reasons in the next minute as to why we should
be,
certainly our listeners and anyone else should be checking into the Siam.
Well, it's the first super luxury resort to be built in the city, and we're built in the old part of Bangkok. When you travel as a leisure tourist, you want to see the old town. You want to be near the palaces. You want to be able to walk to the temples. And at the Siam, you can do that. We're on the river. We have 39 pool villas and suites. 11 of those are private pool villas, the first private pool villa in Bangkok. We have 4 restaurants, the first luxury Muay Thai kickboxing gym ever built anywhere
in the
world.
That's for us, Gwen. Gwen will be ringside. Yeah, listen, every Saturday. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you'll also get the best service in the city. Mm. Okay. It comes from the heart.
All right. Well, we're going to come back. Gwen will, of course, be here, you know, keeping you honest. And
I look forward to
you can write a few more stories for us, Gwen. And I look forward to coming back and checking.
We'll
Jason Friedman, Managing Director of the Siam Hotel, thanks for joining us. Gwen, I'll be back with a few more words to say goodbye from Bangkok right after this. And that's all for this special Bangkok edition of Midori House here in the Thai capital. Gwen, how was it for you?
It was real. In fact, it was Sanuk, as the Thais would say, as in fun.
Okay. Well, we're hoping that the fun also continues. It is also a Friday evening here. We have to be back tomorrow. Gwen and I will, of course, be looking after The Review, a special Thai edition of The Review. But today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and David Michon, and they were ably assisted by Jack Phillips, who is keeping everyone in line on the other side of the wall here on the sound side, and also Alex Funnel. Gwen, I know you... Well, I'm hoping... By the time we get to the studio, that you're going to take us to some of your versions of your favorite drinking spots and your Thai izakayas this evening. I hear so much about them. Might this happen?
Tyler, I don't know what you're doing, burnishing my reputation.
Exactly.
Yes, all I can say is I will do my best.
Okay. But of course, it's time to say goodbye. So it's goodbye from me, Tyler Brulé.
And goodbye from me, Gwen Robinson.